This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Hey, thanks for listening to this Joy podcast. If you like what we do and you listen to our podcast on a regular basis, it's time to put your money where your ears are. It's Radiothon. Go to joy.org.au, become a member, or donate, and keep us out loud and proud so we can make more of the stuff you like.
Broadway icon John Cameron Mitchell channels the essence of his glam rock icon, Hedwig and the Angry Inch, for one night only at Arts Centre Melbourne this July. So put on some makeup, turn up the A-track, and pull the wig down from the shelf. John Cameron Mitchell, July 10 at Arts Centre Melbourne. Book now. Joy sponsor.
Here's another Saturday Magazine podcast brought to you by Joy sponsor, Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
A unique mix of world news and queer culture, Saturday Magazine, every Saturday, 10 till 12, on Joy 94.9.
And you are listening to Saturday Magazine with Tass and my special co-host today, Bronwyn Pike. We now have in the studio Misha Ketchell. Misha is a very experienced journalist and editorial manager in print, TV and online. Currently is the managing editor for The Conversation. Everybody knows The Conversation. And if you don't know The Conversation...
Get on board.
Just get on board. It is fantastic. In terms of, you know, Misha's credentials, Misha was previously the editor of Crikey. He was the founding editor of The Big Issue in Australia, and he was the editor of The Melbourne Weekly, all great, great initiatives. He did spend 6 years at the age as a reporter, a feature writer, an editorial writer, and 4 years at the ABC where he worked on the 7:30 report. Good morning to you, Misha.
Good morning.
Really good to have you in the studio. What we want to talk about today is politics.
Okay, he says with some trepidation.
I'm just going to open it up. Before we talk about politics, tell us about The Conversation. How does that work?
So The Conversation was founded in Melbourne in 2011, so about 7 years ago.
That long?
Yep, it's been going for 7 years. And really it's an idea about trying to deal with media failure. The fact that to be able to have opinions about matters that are topics of public discussion, you actually need to be armed with quality information, with the actual evidence. And because of the way that the media world has been changing so rapidly, we've seen a rise of misinformation, particularly online.
Is this what we call fake news?
Fake news is one example of it, but it's not the only form. I mean,
opinion-led news?
Yeah, opinion-led news is another example of it. Also,
more types are there.
Also, I mean, there's a lot of information that's being peddled by vested interests where the vested interests aren't clear. I would put what they call native advertising as an example of that. So there are lots of ways. If you go, for example, online and you look for information, you can be misled in various ways. And there are lots of ways in which our sort of public discussion isn't as well informed as it potentially could be.
Well, the diet industry is a perfect example, isn't it? You know,
exactly.
10 ways you can lose belly fat. And then you keep scrolling down and eventually you'll find the pill that you've actually got to get for before you can open the next page.
That's right. And partly that's a consequence of the fact that all media outlets, you know, for all time have been driven by the need to support their operations. So that it tends to be that decisions are made on what will attract people's attention as much as on how accurate the information is. So basically The Conversation was an idea about working with academics to get them to share their knowledge and expertise to better inform the public. So if you're going to have a debate about Australia's role in Afghanistan, people need to know where it is and they need to know the history and they need to know a bit about the conflict. If you want to have a discussion about the NBN, you can't do that unless you've got some sense on what the original model was that was proposed, how it works overseas, what we're trying to achieve. And so often when you look in the media, you get these little news stories that say government says this, opposition says that. You get a sense that there's some conflict, but you actually have no way of really working out what's going on. So the idea is...
Yeah, what the substance is.
Yeah, the idea is getting academics involved really for almost sort of explanatory journalism, new research, and just providing useful information for people.
So, Misha, yeah. As editor, how do you decide what articles get published?
So we work like any other newsroom. So we start every morning with the news conference. And if something happens in the news, then we think about how we can cover it. So MH370 happens and we would say, okay, there's a lot of discussion about where we're going to search for debris. Let's get an oceanographer or somebody who can explain how you model ocean currents to explain that to readers. And then we might actually say, rather than just doing an 800-word opinion piece, let's do an interactive, or let's build something that demonstrates or shows how that works. If there's a discussion about footballers taking illegal drugs, you know, we'll get a biochemist to explain what the drugs are.
And what I've noticed on a couple of occasions is that you might publish a perspective one day and a different perspective the next day.
That's true. Although,
is that an attempt to sort of be balanced?
Yes, in a way, although I'd sort of, in a sense, we're really trying to avoid that opinion paradigm, that whole idea, because there's so much opinion online now. And the reason there's so much opinion is because media companies have got less money than they used to have, and it's really expensive to do anything other than express an opinion. Opinion is reasonably cheap. So when we publish academics, we don't have a problem with them expressing their opinions on key topics. That's if you've got expertise, if you're writing something about asylum seeker policy and you've studied that for 15 or 20 years and you've got deep expertise and you've formed a view about what the best thing to do is, we're quite happy to publish that view. We think that's a good thing. But we're not publishing it because the person's expressing the opinion. What we really want is everybody who reads an article to finish the article knowing more than when they started.
And the other, I guess, is it true that you've attracted a lot of interest from academics because it's not easy for academics also to publish, so it becomes an opportunity for them. And so there's this added scrutiny of having to have, you know, really robust research-based stuff that comes out in the public arena through your forum.
That's right. I mean, universities are funded by the public and they're public interest institutions to serve the public. Mm. Yet for so many years, so much of the knowledge that academics have has been locked away in the institutions, while on the other hand, we've been having these, at times, relatively poorly informed public discussions. Mm. So the idea is about linking the two, getting the academics an opportunity to share their expertise. And to be honest, academics love doing it. We've got more than 15,000 Australian academics registered on our site. There's, I think, something like 40 or 50,000 globally. We've got teams in the UK, the US, Africa, France.
Would have been
Canada.
Great. I can tell you, when I was a minister, you know, when Minister for Health, for example, running a very big and complex system and often asked to give very simplistic answers like, can you fix the sixth system? And you try and say, well, you know, I can improve it, I can do this, but can you fix it? Can you make it, you know, can you do this, can you do that? And of course, anybody with half a brain knows that when you've got millions of moving parts and all of that, you can't fix it in a like that.
It's not like an injection.
Whereas an informed debate really talks about the choices that you have to make, you know, the consequences of certain decisions versus others, all that kind of stuff.
That's right. And also, while you're trying to make your decisions, there actually might be academics in universities here in Victoria or across the country who could actually really help you. But their work is sometimes written in a language and published in a form that, as a minister, is actually not going to be useful to you. So one of the things that we do is, by translating the ideas into plain language that is really easy to understand, we get a lot of feedback from politicians and particularly staffers in politicians' offices that they use our content for briefings or to inform ministers or other people who are making decisions.
So they obviously haven't been doing it haven't got a link into Pauline Hanson.
No.
Is that a good bridge, Tess?
That's a great bridge, Bronwyn. So tell us what's happening in Canberra with Pauline Hanson and One Nation.
Well, I mean, I think the first thing to say is, you know, your guess is as good as mine. I mean, really,
is it really that scattergun?
I think it is. I mean, I think there's two things you could say about it. I mean, the Hanson Party, a lot has been written and said about the fact that to some extent there's a cult of personality there and that Pauline Hanson's personal style is very dictatorial. So you've got that sort of personality politics side of it. The other side of it that I think is really interesting and perhaps is even more important is the longer-term trend that is fed Hansonism for all these years, which really is about declining trust in politicians, declining trust in institutions, and really declining trust in our major political parties. And if you look at everything from all of the survey measures of trust in politicians. Australia has got very, very low levels of trust in political leaders. Mm. And also there's been a long-term trend really away from the two major political parties in terms of voting trends.
And, as you said, other institutions. We don't trust our banks, we don't trust our churches, we don't trust our politicians. All our institutions have let us down.
That's right. And I think in that context, when people support something like Pauline Hanson's party, there's an aspect of voting for something. There is that personality. There are certain policies that
but
might...
But there's also an element of protest as well, isn't there?
There's an element of protest, and that makes that attraction relatively fickle, I think. So, you know, you've seen Pauline Hanson come and go and then come again, and what happens next is unclear. And partly that's because also it, as a party, in terms of its capacity to offer real policies that can make our lives better, the thinking is very much on a the level of an emotional register, not not sort of very informed. It's not a, not really a developed policy agenda. And I think one other thing to say about this whole Pauline Hanson thing most recently is actually to look at the issue behind it, which has triggered it all, which is about company taxes, right?
Yes.
Mm. Now, there was a journalist for the ABC, Emma Alberici, who wrote a story earlier this year which tried to answer the question, which I would argue is the question journalists should be asking, which is...
Do these work?
Does it work? Does it make our lives better?
That's right.
This is a policy.
Does it work?
Will it grow the economy and create employment, which is the argument that they have more money, they hire more people, they pay the people more, and we grow the economy.
And in fact, what happened was they went to a huge amount of effort to discredit Emerald Breaching.
That's right. And then what happened was there was a complaint to the ABC and the story got rewritten. And I don't know if anyone ever picked up on what the rewritten version looked like, but it was a travesty in my view of journalism. What they actually did in the first paragraph was they said, Malcolm Turnbull took a who's who of business leaders on his recent trip to the US. And to me, instantly, a story that was about informing readers about whether this tax would work or not, which is an important democratic question, became a story about somebody very important has gone to the United States and you should basically trust the importance of these people and the who's who that did it.
Yes.
And then the next four paragraphs quoted extensively from the president of the Business Council of Australia. Now, I've got nothing against the president of the Business Council of Australia. I'm sure she's a very intelligent and talented person, but she's in a position where she is representing a vested interest in that debate and is not in a position to give you a dispassionate view
but she
on
also
whether the
couldn't,
tax will
she
work
also
or not.
Couldn't deliver an answer to the question.
That's right. So, I mean, I think one of the things that we need from journalism is actually drilling down to what, you know, will this thing help me or not? And actually, on the company tax cut, there is some evidence that it would have some very, very weak impact on wages, but overall, it's not very compelling.
We've had a lot of messages. 317, we always love hearing from you. Keep it coming. Thank you very much. We are chatting about federal politics and we're talking about quality of journalism. So we won't go back to your discussion, 317, about suicide at this stage, but we'll pick it up later on in the show. So, Misha, where were we at? We've just finished talking about...
But, you know, let's talk about the conservative side of politics.
Absolutely.
We you know, people are probably sick to death of talking about Barnaby Joyce. Misha has written extensively on this issue and, you know, maybe you can talk a little bit about your view about the public and the private. It's a never-ending debate. Is the personal political or, you know, is the private part of the public?
So a few months ago I wrote an article for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, you know, putting my personal view, which was that when the Daily Telegraph published the story about Barnaby Joyce's relationship with his staffer, I thought that that was an inappropriate thing to do. And, you know, it wasn't a very popular opinion. I understand a lot of people are very angry with Barnaby Joyce for good reasons, and I think his, you know, public positions on many issues are deplorable, in particular, obviously, same-sex marriage. My view is that if you are going to critique a political figure, you need to do it based on their public position and on their public role, on their capacity to do their public role. And I think that personal hypocrisy is a very weak rationale for invading somebody's private life. My personal view is that everybody's sex life should be private. who they have, you know, sexual relationships with, who they have affairs with. I don't think it's a matter of legitimate public interest.
You're absolutely right, Misha. But, I mean, you know, somebody like Barnaby Joyce actually was very influential in not only in his electorate, but right across the public debate around marriage equality. And he, in fact, was making claims about who I can have a relationship with and what sort of relationship I can have with them. Now, this is where your argument starts to get a bit grey, I think.
Well, no, because, I mean, my view is that the way you rebut that is you say precisely that, you know, who are you to say who I can have a relationship with, and that's not appropriate. But I think once you start to say the way to rebut somebody's public positions is to go into their private life and reveal their hypocrisy, you're on a very slippery slope. I remember when I worked at Media Watch, we covered that story about when Channel 7 outed that New South Wales politician,
yes,
for going to Ken's of Kensington. Now, I thought that that was utterly outrageous invasion of privacy. Channel 7 justified it on the grounds that as a politician, because this man had a secret, he was subject to blackmail. Now, I don't buy that argument. I think that's a ridiculous argument. If he had had pro-family values positions publicly, would that have justified the outing? I don't think so either. I think what an individual does in their private life is private. You can, sometimes what they do in their private life might be contradictory to what they say publicly. But what we've got a right to assess them on as voters, as citizens, is their public positions and how their public positions impact on their
lives.
But
don't you think that there's this sort of notion of authenticity? So if you are advocating a particular point of view, but you in fact, you know, live quite a different position, how does that
fit?
Well,
I mean, the trouble with that argument, Tess, and this is where I actually, you know, think Misha's argument has strength, is that we're very selective about which bits of personal behaviour that we think are contradictory to public positions. So when it comes to sex and who you have sex with, everybody gets very excited. You know, you're on about family values. But, you know, we've got people that take public positions on equality, on social justice, wage positions and, you know, caring for the poor, and then personally live very lavish lifestyles. Now, we don't seem to get as horrified about that sort of stuff as we might do. So, you know, we all contradict in our lives. You know, none of us ever add up to full authenticity. So there is a sense about, you know, where do you draw the line? The only other thing and of course Bill Clinton was the classic sufferer in this situation. Magnificent president, completely undone by that personal stuff. But I guess the other thing is, where's the line? Is it criminal behaviour? We would be horrified if someone was involved in domestic violence, for example. There's some aspects of the personal that are public, that are political. Where do we kind of draw those lines?
Yeah, I think that's true. And obviously when something like, say, charges of domestic violence reach the court system, we've got an open justice system, and that obviously is reportable. But even in circumstances like that, I would suggest that you would want to have a certain level of, you know, sobriety where charges are brought before somebody has been found guilty. Mm. I just think that really this dates back to a change that happened in the US in the 1980s when there was a candidate for president. His name was, I think it was Gary Hart. There was a newspaper in Florida that revealed a story about him having an affair. And we've sort of moved into this world now where that sort of reality TV paradigm, we've got a reality TV president, and we've got a sort of a reality TV paradigm about reporting our politicians. So it's like every sort of, you know, utterance, every sense of their personality, how they treat people around them, all these sorts of things, which are all pertinent to an extent. You can argue a level of pertinence, but I would just say that whole culture of treating it as being about the personalities actually just distracts from things like...
Mind you, it hasn't hurt Trump. I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? You know, that whole thing about, you know, the things he said about women, and now this whole, you know, known publicly all of his sort of affairs and all of that sort of stuff. Does it hurt him?
Well, no, I mean, it hasn't.
Because it's, in a sense, bought into the whole thing, hasn't
that's
it?
Right.
He plays in that world.
So, I mean, there's an aspect in which you could say that the... at one point, this sort of reality TV culture was very much about not being caught out, not having any flaws, not having, you know, skeletons in your closet. But now it's become almost, if you can play that game, including the skeletons, and sort of build it all into part of the entertainment. But I would just argue that that whole sort of personality entertainment, it's a distraction from the policies. Yeah. At the end of the day, with Barnaby, we knew what he said was morally reprehensible from the beginning. We could just say
it wouldn't have mattered whether he'd had an affair or not.
I don't think so. I mean, the arguments were so strong. And interestingly, you know, I mean, his position didn't have majority support. It never did. So
can we do a quick turnaround, Tess?
Please go.
Let's go to another issue that the fear of China's involvement.
This is a big leap from Barnaby Joyce to China.
Jeez, Bron.
Bigger, but I think it's a really, really interesting issue. You know that is this a distraction? Here, the conversation. What are the truth bearers tell us about this story?
Oh my God, that's a very hard one. There are legitimate issues and concerns, and simultaneously there is an extent to which some of the commentary and some of the analysis is somewhat overheated. So there are definitely issues about Chinese government influence. You've got this debate about Huawei, I think. How you pronounce it?
The telephone company.
You know, working on 5G and, you know, whether it's the argument from that company is that it's not formally part of the Chinese regime. But however, you know, there are lots of evidence that it is influenced heavily by the party. So it's incredibly complex, and it's very complex actually in the university sector, which is increasingly enrolling large numbers of students from China, and has lots of partnerships and relationships with China sort of educationally.
So is there a legitimate concern that China would try and influence the outcome of the by-elections in July? Is that legitimate or is that dog whistling?
Oh, that's a good question. I mean,
I don't think there's a yes or no answer to that question, Bron.
Oh, I'm asking the expert.
It's a good question. Look, I honestly don't know. No, I mean, probably
you're right.
Probably not at that level. I don't think.
Yeah. Is it a distraction? Are they using it as a distraction? Quite frankly, it's easy to blame the enemy over there because you're so hopeless here.
I think potentially it's. The way that the influence is working, it's sort of it's an incremental influence. I don't think it's about, you know, necessarily swinging in particular election. It's about setting up structures where people who are influenced by, you know, by the Chinese regime actually, you know, have positions within Australian society.
Yeah.
Look, there's been lots of revelations. There is a lot to be concerned about, but
Clive
it needs
Hamilton's
to be dealt with
a very,
very
reputable academic. So
yes.
The fact that he's written a book about it should raise people's interest.
And it was also interesting that Clive found it difficult to find a publisher for that book. And I think that there were, you know, concerns around the influence of, again, the Chinese government and how it would respond. So, I mean, all these things are real to an extent, but I wouldn't overstate them. Be careful.
Mishra, it's been great having you in the studio. Fantastic. We've run out of time, unfortunately. There's so much more we could talk about. I think what we'll do is we'll have you back in the studio again and just chew the fat for longer.
Fantastic. Well, thank you.
Yeah,
that's great fun.
Thank you for coming in. Yeah. It's been very, very interesting.
On a Saturday morning, it's always a big ask.
And if you haven't subscribed to The Conversation, you should. It is a great daily dose of informed, evidence-based discussion, I suppose.
Yep.
There you go.
Saturday Magazine on Joy 94.9, proudly sponsored by Virgin Australia. Visit virginaustralia.com.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.